And today, in lieu of the traditional moderator's prerogative of asking the first questions, I thought we might engage a little and participate in a Tocqueville-inspired pop quiz. How many of us in the room serve on the board of a public body of any kind? Okay. How many of us serve on the board of a nonprofit, private body of any kind? Very good. How many of us serve on both?
On what?
Just a couple. All right. Just to carry the exercise a little bit further, who serves on as many as three nonprofit boards? Okay, we're doing pretty well. I think de Tocqueville would be give us maybe a B+. All right, so we've got a couple questions coming in. And before I address this, though, I do want to give our speakers the opportunity, after having heard each other's presentations, to engage in any questions among themselves. If there are any, please go ahead. And if not, we'll start taking questions from both the floor and from Slido, as is our custom.
I'm good.
Anyone?
I've got a quick question.
Please.
So I was curious. Mic on?
Yeah, I'm not going to turn your head today.
Okay. Sure. Ty should follow. But for Dr. Jewell, I'm curious. So when the neighborhood that I grew up in New York, in Queens.
No, it's not over. Sorry.
Need a handheld, maybe? Oh, sounds like my mic's on.
Is my mic on now?
Yeah.
There it is. Okay. So, my family, we used to go to the Sons of Italy Festival at one point every summer. The neighborhood used to be working class, Irish and Italian. Then, you know, Black American families moved in, families from the West Indies moved in. And I'm curious, do you think that those types of sort of ethnically or culturally based associations have any chance of either being started or flourishing in a society that's as sensitive around issues related to race and culture as ours is today? And I guess that might be a voluntary association question as well.
Yeah, I'm not, is mine on now?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm not an expert on that particular kind of association. I think that historically, of course, they played a very important role in major cities in the United States. I think that some of the European cultures like Italian or Irish, for example, you can celebrate those cultures without necessarily running into the race question to a certain point.
Understood.
Because you can celebrate like a sub-white category, but you can't celebrate the white category. That's one of the like unwritten rules, right?
So no white citizens council?
No, nothing like, I mean, I don't think you could get away with that.
Okay.
And you would have the media firestorm and all that sort of thing, but you could have some kind of celebration of ethnic culture, of, you know, Swiss Americans or Polish Americans. So I think you can still do that in places where there's a critical mass of that to celebrate that heritage and that culture. I think that's a very healthy thing.
Okay.
All right, well, I'm now gonna open it up to questions, and the gentleman at the mic, please.
Thanks so much. I appreciated your presentation. Sean Watley from Toronto. I'm visiting here and enjoying it very much. With respect to your 2x2 table and institutional reform, in my experience, it requires a different skill set and a different approach to storm the gates and take over an institution versus having the skills and abilities to actually run that organization when you take it over. And actually, each of your four quadrants seem to speak to a different predisposition, a different character, a different set of skills. So I'm wondering if you can help us understand how we can storm the gates, take over an institution, and then actually transition to the people who know how to run it. Or are we expecting an omnicompetent group of conservatives who can function in each quadrant? Thanks.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think that one reason why conservatives have been so adept at the withdraw and restart strategy is because we have emphasized since World War II, this idea of the entrepreneur and the startup mentality and all that sort of thing. And so that meshes very well with that particular quadrant. But I think there are some lessons to take from the business world here. There are people who are good at doing startup businesses, and then once the business gets to a certain size, they find it prudent to hand the reins over to someone who can take more of a managerial role rather than the person who's going to go out there and really be looking for the new opportunities for the business. So I think that within the movement, one of the things we need to do is try to identify those different skills and figure out how to slot people in to where they will perform the best. Because the temptation is, you know, if all you have is one skill set, if all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail, and you want to take the same approach to everything, and that's not appropriate in every set of circumstances. So that's a problem that we need to do a lot more thinking about. I thank you for that question.
Okay, I think this is a question for Delano, and so I'll read this from Slido. To what extent do you think the financial incentives in the welfare system contribute to the decline of marriage? And if so, what can be done?
Yes, I mean, that's a very common question. I think it's one of the things that where there's sort of unanimous agreement in our building at the Heritage Foundation in terms of wringing the marriage penalties out of the welfare state. My sense is that today, the couples who are choosing to have children without the benefit of marriage are not doing so because of, you know, sort of the conditions within the welfare state. And I'm not just talking about low-income couples. It is surprising to me, and this is going to be sort of an imprecise measure of how culture has shifted, but I'm old enough to remember a time when if a man and a woman just moved in together, like in an apartment, they were, you know, the elders would say they were shacking up and that was sort of frowned upon. But I can't tell you how many college-educated couples I know who are buying homes together without the benefit of marriage. So I think part of why I started where I did is because certainly policy incentives matter. And certainly if we were doing a retrospective, and you're talking about the 1960s, sort of the explosion of the welfare state, they matter a lot. If you pay a single mom, you're going to incentivize more single mothers. But I think now what we're looking at, particularly after two generations, multiple generations of adults who've gone through divorces with parents or people who've never seen married couples in their family, is that this has become a cultural norm. And that's why I'm saying I use the words like valuable, accessible, desirable, and indispensable. So I don't think, for instance, even if you got rid of all the marriage penalties, that is going to make the average 24-year-old in West Baltimore decide, oh, I'm going to marry this woman before we have children. I hope that answers the question.
I think so. So let's go back to the floor and the gentleman at the mic, please.
Hello, Aramis Perez from Miami, so I'm a proud Florida man. I wonder whether you all might be able to draw a connection between your remarks and those of Professor Dragos this morning about the kind of incipient totalitarianism that we're observing becoming a feature of American life. It's replacing, hollowing out this kind of organic, real associational life. As we try to restore the body politic to health, are we thinking broadly enough? Are we understanding that in order to have what we would see as a flourishing human life, there are an entire series of American institutions that need to change very much for the better? Try and map it out from, you know, the birth to maturity and think, okay, well, maybe there's the family you're born into, maybe it's the preschool, if preschool's part of the picture. You get a job, can you flourish in that job without political reprisals or consequences? It seems kind of extreme to frame it that way, but it's becoming more and more common. Can you achieve the American dream if you work for a top company that requires you to express certain opinions on gender politics, and you don't want to do that? So my question is for comments about whether we think broadly enough and long-term enough about restoring American institutions to health? And if so, how do we further it? If not, how do we adjust that? Thank you.
Yeah, so I'm sure you're familiar with Robert Nisbet's argument in Quest for Community about the growth of the modern state and the way it pushes out all of those institutions, makes them ephemeral, and over time replaces their functions, kind of takes over their functions. And one important argument he makes is the apparatus, the administrative apparatus, makes very difficult the founding of new ones. It's kind of one important, kind of often ignored part of his arguments. It's not just institutions come and go, it's that new ones can't come into existence in a meaningful sense. They can't take on the functional significance in the lives of their members. And so there is a sense in which our institutions struggle to take institutional significance in our lives. I mean, what is the importance of the family? Nisbet has this great passage in Quest for Community, published in 1953, where he talks about how worthless the family has become. It has no function. It's on its way out, he basically says. It's 1953, you know, and he's, of course, quite prescient that it had already given up its educative functions, a lot of its socialization functions, its religious education function. What was left for it to do? And he recognized as a historian of sociology, what that would mean for the institution. So one question for us is, how do we return them to significance? And I think your point is lurking totalism, I think, surrounding kind of the woke ideology and in the way it's captured a lot of institutions, such that it's going to be difficult to rise in this world without compromise of conscience. So one thing we might be thinking about is what it looks like for other institutions, and I think they exist, Federalist Society, for example, for lawyers anyway, that can provide status and significance to its members in a way that might be parallel paths. One thing to keep in mind is there came a point in Roman history, for example, when the sons of the great aristocrats started entering the church rather than become quaestors or something like that. They didn't seek the high offices in Rome. They sought the high offices in the church, like Ambrose, for example. Because they held status and authority that was comparable to those other institutions. We might think about what it looks like to plot out those sort of parallel institutions. Raising the specter of the family where it's gaining a position at the head of the family as a mother or father is something to be sought for, because it is, as it used to be, a place of status, a place that brought you recognition from your local community. We might even think how we individually treat people who have chosen those sorts of paths, and do we treat them with the respect they're due? But these are kind of small things, but you're on the right track of how do we start to lift it up. So we might think about how we build our institutions and how we'll help people in this room kind of achieve that sort of status and path.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll take the next question from Slido, which I think any of our panelists could address admirably, which is, how should we respond when even churches have become so progressive as to support progressive causes such as the trans movement, flying the intersectionality flag, and et cetera?
Well, I'll say something about that since that, you know, I mentioned churches in some of the quadrants in my talk. There are churches out there that don't compromise on those questions. And if making a prudential assessment, you think that for the foreseeable future, the church that you might be part of that is compromising on those things, and you're concerned about maybe the spiritual health of your kids or yourself, maybe you need to reaffiliate. That might be in that quadrant of withdrawing, and you wouldn't be restarting a new institution, but you would be realigning your own, your own life to a certain extent to this other religious fellowship. And there are certainly costs to that. There's social costs. There could be professional costs. I mean, like if you leave the Episcopal Church for a Baptist church, like there's definitely a professional cost for that, I would say. And there always has been. So you've got to make a prudential assessment, I think, in those areas, but always be on the lookout for opportunities to reform. I mean, the Episcopal Church, apologies to any Episcopalians, Brad Watson, I mean, I think that in 20 years it might convert into a real estate investment trust, because there won't be any parishioners left anymore, just a bunch of real estate. So is that a situation where it might be exhausted and be ready for recapture at that point? I don't know. Maybe the people who are in charge there are so entrenched and would rather die 1,000 deaths than turn some of that real estate over to conservatives, and it might be a lost cause. But that's something like, I'm not going to have a comprehensive answer on all that, but I think that's one of the areas where we need to do more work in trying to identify what the opportunities are for reform or recapture of some of those institutions, while also being, as a last resort, withdrawing and starting something new.
Yeah, and I certainly would agree with that. Can you all hear me? Can you hear me?
No?
Okay, there you go. There you go. If you attend a church that raises a trans flag, you should see that for what it is, which is an institution that's been captured. So the first moment you see that, I think you should leave, period. Because it's no longer a church. It's not teaching any sort of solid doctrine. And in many respects, what Dr. Jewell just described is sort of the tension that a lot of parents have with respect to schools. So they will have education advocates and activists that say, oh, no, we just need more resources and we can turn the school around. But by the time that happens, I mean, your child will be 18 and reading at a third grade level. So I think there's certain ways in which you can fight for reform while making personal decisions that are in the best interest of your family. Because as a husband and a father, I have to put the interests of my wife and children as sort of my primary motivation, and not just the health of a particular institution. But again, and I live in D.C., I live right outside of D.C., so I've seen a number of churches. I mean, there are parts of the city where a BLM and a trans or pride flag are much more prominently displayed than a cross on a particular church. So I think you should see that for what it is, which is a captured institution.
Yeah, so I think we should, I think everything that's been said right now is correct. But we might think about what it takes to really strengthen those institutions that haven't strayed. So it's not, what does it take to really build them up and pour themselves into them? I think Rod Dreher got some deserved criticism for his Benedict option, but one thing he was thinking about was, what does it take to make sure that our institutions are hardy? Do we think about that? What will make sure that the denominations that haven't gone that route remain strong, that they remain with their integrity intact and all these sorts of things? And it's certainly a little, it's easy to despair, I think, at the current state of some of the churches. But I think exit is a good option in those cases, but also building up when exit isn't obvious. What does it take to really strengthen us? How would we make sure that this institution doesn't go that route? And what actions can we take today, not 10 years from now when it's too late, but today to ensure that?
Okay, let's go back to the mic.
Hi, I'm Knox. Mr. Squires, thanks for your work on marriage and family.
Thank you.
Great to have a millennial voice on the panel. Relatedly, you mentioned Red Pill and MGTOW. Where do you think those movements are coming from? And what does it say about young conservative men?
There's a part of me, the New York skeptic, that wonders if these movements aren't sort of being funded by the feminist left, because honestly, many of them sound exactly the same. I don't think that's the case. I think it's a number of things. And over the last couple of months, I have become a little bit more sensitive, may not be the word, but I understand the point that some of the red pill guys are making. I think some of them are decent at diagnosis. They're terrible at prescription. Because if what you end up telling men is, I've literally seen some of these individuals who say, if you want to be a high-value man in your 20s, get a vasectomy. I'm not. I mean, again, I had to probably had to turn it over and say, is that Gloria Steinem back there? You know, like who would tell a man to get a vasectomy at 20 years old? But I think men are reacting to what they see as an unfairness in our legal system with respect to public policy around divorce and children. One individual who ran for elected office in Texas went through a very nasty divorce with his wife, who was trying to, quote unquote, transition his child in Texas. And when he came out of that, and she was awarded custody, but he had, I think, joint medical decision-making authority, he now goes around telling men, don't get married. If you want to secure your posterity, have children through surrogacy and adoption. So I think, like many feminists, some of these men are speaking out of a sort of a deep personal sense of pain, but I also think some of them see the writing on the wall and see how easy it is, for instance, for a woman to say, you know what, this is not really serving me, as I said, and, you know, go through with a divorce. He's on the hook for child support, spousal support. And in fact, and I'm saying this because I know people in these situations, the man is paying her even though she makes more money. And what I was told is that even if she gets remarried in a particular period of time, he is still on the hook for that. I mean, if you sort of lay out that incentive structure for the average 25-year-old, he's going to say, no way, I do not want to take part in that deal. So I do think part of this has to be a conversation about policy and law, but a big part of it has to be a conversation about norms and culture.
Thank you.
All right, let's go ahead and continue with questions from the floor. Professor Forte.
Thank you. A comment and then follow up with a question, if I may. There was a comment, I think, by Delano about going to the Italian festival, and I'm Italian-American, and what I notice about ethnic festivals, Greek, Italian, German, is that they're celebratory, and they're invitatory, and they're happy to share their Italian cooking and so forth. Other identity groups are inward-looking, victimization, don't appropriate what I have, big difference between BLM and a black jazz festival, for example. It's a huge difference between that. And what I've seen with Italian Americans is that they can be affected recently by the victim association, first of all, taking down Columbus statues. And then I saw in one Italian American group, they're talking about how Italian Americans during World War II were discriminated against by the government. Oh yeah, but listen, we bore it up and we went on. We didn't make that an issue. That's why we were American, you know? Now they're making that. So now my comment, which slides over to a similar characterization of male and female. You just talked about the question about young men and what's gonna happen if they get caught in having to do child support. You have not yet talked, anyone has not yet talked about the deprecation of manhood qua manhood, and the fact that not only are men as fathers not celebrated, but women as single mothers are celebrated as single mothers. It's a point of pride. It's a point of accomplishment. One of my students came into my office last month, and as we were talking, she said, you know, I'm a single mother. And she expected me to praise her for that. I could tell by her voice. She expected me to praise. Oh, isn't that one? She expect, and of course she expected me to praise her because everyone praises her for that. So I don't. My question is, what do you do with this conundrum when what is being man, not male, what is being man is deprecated ever since the 60s, and what is being a female who is not tied to a man in any constructive and mutually supporting way is being celebrated. And you came up with an idea about how we have a mass marriage celebration, but this gets down more to the nub of male and female. I don't know how you handle that.
I think that's a fantastic question. And yes, I think we have to start early with the next generation to your point, we went sort of the women's rights movement went from trying to fight masculinity, well, trying to fight sexism, to sort of demonizing masculinity. And that has been a significant problem, because if you tell anyone that they're a problem for long enough, they're going to, you know, probably start to believe you. I think a number of things have to be done. One is to have some type of corrective for young boys early. And this is where fathers play a tremendous role in affirming their sons, in roughhousing. I know, you know, part of what I try to do is to model for my sons the type of, you know, the type of husbands that I would want them to be when they grow up, because of some of the messages that they get out there in the world. So it is difficult. I think both boys and girls are in a difficult situation, because for 60 years, we've told young women that the height of being a woman is acting like a man. And now we're sort of on the other side and telling young men that to be a better man, you have to act like a girl. So, and that's not just cultural messaging. Like, we're literally losing what it means to be a man, a male and a female. So some of this, again, a lot of this is like restorative work, basic sort of foundational work to encourage a healthy sense of masculinity in boys and femininity in girls. It's hard to do in a culture sort of like the one that we're in, but I think we need to do exactly what it is that you're saying, but it's difficult to do in this situation. One thing I will say, and we're a homeschooling family as well, is that when you control your child's education, you have a lot more influence on the types of things that they're learning on a day-to-day basis. And I am very bullish on home education and school choice in general, partly because of the reason to form children in a more positive and, from my perspective, God-honoring position.
All right, let's continue with Mike.
Difficult question. How are we going to politically reverse some of the most damaging things that have been done to the family? The one single action that was most destructive of the black family was the aid for dependent children that Lyndon Baines Johnson rammed down the throat of America in the 1960s. That made it financially desirable for the woman not to be married. And to me, that is one of the great crimes that the Democratic Party has committed, or collectivists, or whatever you want to call them, against the black community and all other communities where women sometimes are dependent on the federal government for financial aid. Yeah. Very difficult question. I don't know how you would answer it, but I'm going to pose it. What can we do politically to reverse this great crime?
So my answer would be sort of comprehensive, not just politically, but although I do think, you know, politics matter. I mean, an elected official makes policy, obviously. You know, they sign things into law with the pen, but they also have a pulpit and a purse. So I try to, because I try to be a fair person, acknowledge the fact that Barack Obama was probably the last national Democrat who spoke publicly about the importance of marriage, family, and fatherhood with respect to social outcomes. The problem is that when he did that, his critics were always on the progressive left. So when you get to 2020, Democrats removed any reference to marriage from their sort of national policy priorities, except arranged marriages in foreign countries. So I think part of what we need is to have politicians who are willing, and this doesn't have to be a heavy lift. All I would ask them to do is to preach what it is that you practice, because they don't drive the Who's Your Daddy DNA truck around Napa Valley or Martha's Vineyard. So all you know, the members need to do is to say, well, if it works for me, I think it would work for other people. So part of it is to use the bully pulpit. Again, there may be some programmatic things that we can do. Obviously, there's a lot of attention, you know, paid to, you know, child tax credits and maternity leave. Those things are more family-oriented in general. I don't think any of those things would sort of reinvigorate marriage, but here are some other ideas that are not political in nature. For instance, I believe every historically black college and university, every HBCU, should have as part of its mission to improve the relationships between black men and black women, period. Now, they can do that through rhetoric. They can do that in the classroom. They can run a husband camp and a wife school. You know, they can have dating mixers. They can have all types of things to encourage young people to see, particularly men, because guys will never have odds that good that are in their favor the way they do on a college campus. Particularly men to walk away from this four-year experience at least thinking about the importance of marriage and family. I also think that there are certain things that need to be done in the realm of culture and media. As somebody who sort of grew up in New York City, entirely surrounded sort of by, you know, hip-hop culture, it is impossible to sow Snoop Doggy Dogg and reap The Cosby Show, right? So you can't expect a young man who has never heard the women or the girls in his community referred to by anything other than derogatory names to turn around at 20, 21, 25 and say, oh yes, I'd like to marry one of those young ladies. So I think certain things have to be done in popular culture to reverse some of these effects. And then the other thing I would say is this. I think conservatives need to have the right time frame. You're not going to reverse 60 years of damage in one presidential administration. So our time frame has to be, our time horizon has to be generational. So it's not just, you know, the clock or the calendar. We need to be thinking, okay, where do we want to be three generations from now? And to plan accordingly.
All right, I'd like to get our last two questions in from the floor, and we've got precisely 3.5 minutes. So let's try to do our best to keep our questions and our answers clear and crisp.
My name is Daniel Lowenstein. I'm the director of the Center for Liberal Arts and Free Institutions at UCLA. You alluded in passing, Delano, to the fact that women are outnumbering men so much in colleges, and I think increasingly it's getting to professional and graduate schools too. My question is, to what extent may this in part be a result from the way K-12 is taught? My sense is, I was in K-12 in the 50s, basically, and my sense is that the curriculum was sort of oriented more towards boys. We read adventure stories and all kinds of things like that. My sense, but I don't really know, is that it's gone very much in the opposite direction, and I just wanted to ask if any of you know, is the curriculum tilted toward girls at that level, and if so, to what extent and what effect do you think it's having?
You guys are higher ed.
So I think there's some research by, I think, Leonard Sachs addresses that question. I think it was Leonard Sachs. It might have been Lionel Tiger. And he argues that there is, that has been a change. So one story tells is of in kindergarten, when they're coloring pictures, they tend to grade at a lower level, pictures colored by boys. So they, you know, do a study where they take the names off and switch the names around, you know, male and female names to get them to kind of control for that. And the type of pictures boys will draw, car crashes, that sort of thing, movement, tend to get a lower grade. And kind of so starting in kindergarten, the sorts of things boys will be interested in tend to be graded down. So he makes that argument. So it seems to be the case. Didn't seem like that was the case when I was there, but apparently that is a concern. I don't know anything more about it than that.
Professor Bruce.
J. Bruce, John Brown University. The late Roger Scruton said that conservatism starts with the love of the local. Thinking about associations, I'm wondering whether or not we as a movement have and a desire to speak nationally, to fund large institutions nationally, have actually sucked all of the interest, enthusiasm, and funding that would historically have gone to local associations in order to wage these national debates.
I think Jay's trying to get us in trouble. Many representatives of these large national organizations sitting in the room.
All right, we'll let that conversation continue over cocktails at 5:30. So with that, please join me in thanking our speakers.
Good job.
Yep, we'll now have a 30-minute break. We'll see you back in 30 minutes. Thank you.